Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Hi, everybody. This is Bob Bazanko, co-host of the Green and Red podcast, going solo today. And we're going to talk about perhaps the most pressing issue going on right now, and there's a lot of them, which is Iran, Israel's attacks on Iran and potential of a U.S. attack, perhaps, a nuclear attack on Iran. And we have a frequent guest and a really great friend and an absolutely brilliant scholar, Skander Siddiqui, who is a professor in the history department at the University of York in England and the author of Revolution and Its Discontents. I got it right this time. And he's been doing a lot of media lately on Iran. And so we're really happy to have him here and really fortunate. We need a counterweight to what we're hearing in the regular media. And to get started, though, you have family and friends in Tehran. How are they doing and what's the situation like there?
They were elderly. So on the whole, there are obviously younger members of the family who are also like with them, thankfully. But because we have these elderly relatives, particularly my wife's family are in Tehran, we really pleaded with them. They weren't going to, but we implored them to leave because the Israelis had actually announced that they were going to bomb this Area 3, which is an extremely crowded, populous, like urban area full of apartment blocks, full of cafes, juice bars, restaurants. I mean, in the UK, it would be like the equivalent of like bombing like Oxford Street, like Marble Arch and things like this. And I don't know, like you can just imagine like a very kind of popular, like busy area in like New York full of shops and shop and malls and restaurants and so on. It's like that. There's like big parks. So you can imagine like literally bombing where Hyde Park is in London, for instance. It's just really totally egregious. They're okay, fortunately. I think it was a little bit difficult getting out of Tehran, but many people who could, and they're fortunate enough that they could, they've gone to Mazandaran province in the north of Iran, which is near to the Caspian. So fortunately, they're okay. But I do have like very close friends of mine whose parents who are really elderly and not mobile at all. And they are basically just stuck. And they also, maybe their carers have also gotten up and basically left the city in some instances. And they've had to find like replacements. A friend of mine's uncle in the first couple of days was actually killed when he had a pregnant wife who basically only is alive, apparently, I've heard, because she went to check on their toddler in the moment when basically the strike occurred and he was sadly martyred and killed in that. So I think just there's a lot of people dealing with a lot of tragedy. Now the casualty figures of civilians is several hundred at the moment, and 90% at least, if not more, are being reported as civilians. So this is not just strikes against military targets or even the regime and regime officialdom. That's just complete and utter lie. And I think, Iranians, because of that, have shown a significant degree of resilience. And actually, there's actually even like a campaign amongst some people in Tehran saying, I'm not going to leave Tehran. And you have many people who haven't. And I just saw actually footage from today's Friday prayer sermon, which is obviously very much like associated with the Iranian state and sort of the state messaging. So a lot of people might have a lot of people not the Islamic Republic particularly, would never attend such a thing and see absolutely associated with the government. The turnout for that has been very significant, looks very big. So I think it's more about defiance and sort of people coming together and saying they're not going to, whatever differences they might have, they're not going to welcome a foreign conqueror, let alone one which clearly has already killed several hundred of their countrymen and women and many children, which again, should come as no surprise. And we need to see this as part of a longer continuum, which began on October 7th. That's how we need to see this and understand this. And even if many Iranians were somewhat naive and maybe thought that the Israelis and the Americans could do these sort of surgical strikes and they would be, in a sense, spared and wouldn't be impacted by such an act of aggression, I think that has basically been dissipated for the overwhelming majority, very clearly.
Yeah. For sake of comparison, as you said, they're targeting residential areas, civilians, so to speak. How big is Tehran and what's its population? Just to give America.
I mean, it's a mega metropolis. It's a city with 10 to 11 million people. Yeah. It's a city with, and again, I mean, you could even go up to 14 if you talk about the outer, like greater Tehran, and then other places like Karaj, which are nearby, which is now it's another province, but it's basically the one, a close one to Tehran. which has also been hit and hit badly. So many people go from Karaj and commute inwards. So millions of people actually commute into Tehran as well for work, of course. So no, it's a mega metropolis. And I think, like, unfortunately, beyond kind of maybe West Asia, people in Europe and the United States, they have this image of Iran, which is, bears no relation to reality, right? They think it's, I don't know what they think of, often have all sorts of preconceptions. But like I said, they have coffee shops offering Kistim, the latest coffee beans, the latest blends, the latest. It's really, like I said, has hippie markets, has all sorts of mega malls, has everything you would expect of a major city of 11 million people.
Yeah.
Things as uber wealthy, where it's the same price maybe to buy property as it is in Manhattan. It's got everything. It's a real city. It's a real city with a real beating heart.
Yeah. The U.S. portrays it in a North Korea kind of way with this dark and frightening place. And that's important. Given the size, if a foreign country threatened to destroy New York or L.A., I mean, that population is 2.5 times Houston. It's important to understand just what a staggering threat this is.
Yeah. The population of Tehran is bigger than the whole of Israel, obviously. And you just have Israel Katz, there's really foreign minister threatening to obviously burn it down, to kill civilians. You have Trump then in this really maniacal kind of way, basically calling on 11 million people to evacuate in this ridiculous fashion. And I guess this is all part of the psychological warfare. It's about terrorizing the population, not just 11 million people, because obviously these strikes have taken place all across the country, a country of 92 million people.
Yeah.
And it's all about demoralization. And I guess they sense that if they can demoralize and strike at people's kind of morale and belief in countries and the state's ability to defend them, then they think it's going to obviously make their lives easier, their job easier.
This is like the textbook definition of what terrorism is. You instill terror in these massive populations, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the immediate lead up to this, because the narrative is that they want to stop Iran from having nuclear weapons, and that's imminent, which they've been saying for over 30 years now. It's imminent. Okay. It reminds me of, if you follow Cuba, it was Castro's final hour since 1961, 60 years of it, or obviously the WMDs. So Israel, and the important point I think you made, which I think all of us who focus on this stuff talk about, is this is a regional issue. It's a regional war. And so we've seen Israel already in Lebanon and Syria. It's hit Iran. It's assassinated. Last year, we talked about assassination of Iranian diplomats, right? What do you think? Why not? Why now? Why like this? Why did Israel decide now is the time to provoke this massive war while it's undertaking a genocide, starving people, getting not in official channels, but obviously getting international opprobrium from people all over the world, if not the governments? Why now? Why do you think now they decided to blow it all up, literally figuratively?
I don't have anything like definitive. I'm pretty sure maybe diplomatic historians 50 years from now really figure out what exactly, how this unfolded exactly. But obviously there's two theories. One theory is that, of course, Netanyahu didn't want negotiations to succeed.
Sure.
And Iran was in the process of pursuing negotiations on its nuclear program. And obviously for Israel, having an Iran which even has the nuclear capability, so it's basically mastered the nuclear fuel cycle and could have potentially, if it leaves the NPT, a breakout time to build a bomb within a year or so. Which there's so many things which have to happen in that interim, right, for that to even happen. I guess that's one theory, which I think I'm less sold on. I guess the other is that there was obviously significant intelligence, coordination and planning between Israel and the United States on this, and that the Trump administration was persuaded that if Israel basically carries out this decapitation strategy and war, it will break the back of the Iranians, and then Trump can then use that to then leverage capitulation and impose capitulation on the Iranians. And I guess then there's the third option that, basically they're both coordinated on pretty much breaking the back of the Iranian state and pursuing. I think the Israelis are pushing for that, and they're pushing, and if they can get away with it, they would, or they hope it will be the outcome of this. Obviously, just looking at Trump's record, I think we both agree that he's not really one. He's not interested in a long, drawn out campaign. He's certainly not committed to troops and then sending and occupying Iran, a massive country, several times the size of Iraq, with a population far larger than Iraq and all these sorts of things. And then sending American troops back in body bags, like that whole story. So I think like the second, I think he thinks he can leverage the Israelis and he's using them as an attack dog. Well, obviously they're funding them, they're arming them, they're sharing intelligence with them. I mean, you know, from what I understand also, they're probably also doing the mid-air refueling and actually directly supporting them in that regard as well. So it is like a US-Israeli war. It's just obviously Israel is like the headline and at the forefront. And I think he thinks he can leverage capitulation because I guess the one thing that really would separate the Obama deal, the kind of the JCPOA, the Iran deal, was that Iran still had the ability to enrich uranium to very low rates, so like about 3.6%, which has no use if you wish to build weapons. Can only be used for energy and research purposes. But even the fact that Iran has mastered that is too much. It's intolerable to the Israelis and to the Americans, I'm sure, as well. I don't think there's much of a difference there between them. But I think, yeah, the way that Trump can probably distinguish himself from Obama and say, oh, I managed to take us to the brink. At least is what I'm hoping. Anyway, take us to the brink and I managed to, and they're not going to go the whole hog kind of thing. I took us to the brink and I managed through my deal-making abilities, through it was called peace through strength and so on. I managed to actually prevent Iran from even having any kind of nuclear enrichment on its soil, which is something that they continue to put forward. And thus far, Iran has resisted. They've said no, it's not negotiable, basically.
Yeah. That's a good reason. Just to reflect on how long this has been going on, last night I was looking a few things up and I came across an article from 2018. In a recording, Netanyahu boasts Israel convinced Trump to quit Iran deal. That's from 2018. Uh-huh. And then 2020, Israel keeps blowing up military targets in Iran, hoping to force a confrontation before Trump can be voted out of office. So this has been a long-term project. You mentioned the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was signed in 2015, right? Which set up these kind of regulations regarding Iranian nuclear programs, which were intended to be what they would call civilian rather than military. And it seemed to be working. Trump comes in and calls it the worst agreement ever. I never could quite figure that out because I would hear people who don't know they couldn't find Iran, the region in a map, would come in because Fox News said, that's the worst thing ever. And they would repeat it.
His donors saying that.
Yeah, I never quite figured out other than maybe it's true that Trump just hated Obama so much he wanted to just countermand everything he ever did. But why don't you just talk just a little bit about what that is? Because I think this is, in the United States media at least, this nuclear program has become the centerpiece of the whole thing. And again, I've tried to say that. Why don't you just briefly describe what the JCPOA was and how it played out?
Okay, so like in the Obama era, so we have to look at this as like bipartisan as well.
Oh, absolutely.
That's obviously important. The Obama administration did pursue a policy of crippling sanctions against Iran, basically isolating it and kicking it out of the SWIFT system. I mean, if you want to kind of transfer any kind of money to Iran, it's like a nightmare, basically. If there's any mention of it, I've had friends who have literally, for instance, bought records with Iran in the title and PayPal, and the transaction has been suspended or their bank accounts have been suspended. So basically, Obama already pursued this kind of policy of isolating Iran diplomatically, managed to do so at the Security Council as well, imposed very severe sanctions on Iran. Hassan Rouhani is elected in 2013, so he's more like a center-right moderate pragmatist, I would say, figure. He was formerly the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, and then he was elected president in 2013. And then his foreign minister was, of course, Javad Zarif, who's a well-known figure, at least in the English sphere, because his English is good and he tweets a lot and he's quite seen as quite effective in that regard. So they reached the JCPOA with the P5+1. So that's all the members of the Security Council plus Germany, the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. And really, the United States was always the key figure here. If you go back to the Bush administration, where Iran temporarily suspended nuclear enrichment, really the Bush administration really sought to take that away from Iran. They didn't want Iran to have that either. Even under the Shah, the Nixon administration, and then I think the Ford administration was extremely kind of jittery and was actually quite hostile to the idea of Iran actually being able to master the fuel cycle, which it didn't in the Shah's era, but I think the Shah sought to. And then the US administration really sought to prevent that. So it's a long-standing thing, absolutely. I think it's obviously, we also have to say that it's the Israelis who nuclearize the region. It's them, not signatories of the NPT. It's the Israelis who have 200 or so or more undeclared nuclear weapons. And we all know this, and this was actually done with the support of, I guess, South Africa and France and others. So anyway, yeah, getting back to the JCPOA. So the key thing here is that it would limit the amount of enriched uranium that Iran could actually keep on Iranian soil. So as soon as it reached a certain amount, it would have to be dispatched and it would be sent to, I think, Russia, if I'm not mistaken. Iran also destroyed its heavy water reactor. So I think the Israelis just bombed it in Iraq. But literally, as a result of the JCPOA, this is why actually Iran was very, following the breakdown of the JCPOA and American leaders pulling out, they were very angered because for various reasons which I can get into. But basically, Iran poured concrete into that reactor so it basically cannot ever be used again. That's another thing. And then there's this very strict limit that Iran couldn't enrich beyond 3.6%. And also, the IAEA, also so the International Atomic Energy Agency, would have this really rigorous inspection regime. And I just saw this statistic, and it sounds plausible, but I haven't checked it, so I'm going to say with caution. But apparently 50% of all IAEA inspections over the last couple of decades have been in Iran. So Iran was like the most inspected place in the world by the International Atomic Energy Agency by a huge margin. And that was the deal, and it was working. And Iran was abiding by it completely. There's no doubt of that being the case. There is none. But obviously, Iran could then, it did have this right of depth, this ability as well, which it puts a lot of store in, to enrich uranium on its soil. And this was seen very much as a symbol of sovereignty, of independence, of indigenous knowledge production, of all these sorts of things, which Iran put a lot of store in. And the Iranian government obviously has often invested with a lot of kind of Iranian national pride, etc. And this is, I think this is just too much. The Israelis cannot come to terms with this because it makes basically Iran a latent nuclear state, a threshold nuclear state. But again, in a sense, like it does, because it can enrich the uranium. But like for actually Iran to pursue weaponization, it would have to leave the NPT, which would cause a massive national furor. Then it would have to dash to the bomb and be able to put it on the warhead, actually make the divide. It could be years in the making once they decide to break with the inspection regime. So the whole world would know. This is why it's so farcical to say this was a bad deal. If Iran did actually pursue that, it would be known very quickly and the whole world would have been alerted. But of course, we also should remind that the Americans are allowed to have nuclear weapons, Britain, France, all these sorts of, and the Israelis, of course, the Israelis who are carrying out all sorts of war crimes and genocide in Gaza, of course. But we're supposed to believe they're rational actors, whereas Iran, that hasn't invaded a country for hundreds of years, is supposed to be, as soon as they get the bomb, apparently, which they were not pursuing, they're just mad. They just want martyrdom, which is just completely ridiculous. Even while Iran is under bombardment as we speak, the leadership is actually trying to show that they're rational to the world. They're actually saying that the Israelis are the agents of destabilization in the region, still to this point, because they don't want to give any pretext for the Americans to step into the fold, could come into the fold, basically. Yeah, this is the situation. It was working very well. Trump pulls out, imposes this maximum pressure, which was basically itself like a regime change initiative anyway. I don't know if you remember, but when Mike Pompeo was the CIA director, I believe it was the CIA director, not Secretary of State, he gave the sort of 10 points of what the Iranian state needs to do in order for the United States to basically remove sanctions and basically alleviate or take down the temperature. And it was basically calling for the government to dissolve itself, more or less, in all but words. That's what it was tantamount to. It was just ridiculous. So I think, yeah, this is a continuation of that. I know in the States, I guess there was this sense that the first administration had lots of these hawks and neocons and so on. And then the second administration was divided between these more anti-interventionist types, MAGA types, and then those who still were very much of a kind of neoconservative or kind of an aggressive sort of neoconservative posture and had that sort of agenda in mind and were very obviously and saw themselves as aligned with the Israelis, people like, I guess, Mike Waltz and others. And it seems, at least at the minute, Trump is known to be playing between these two tendencies of playing them off one another. And he's not showing his cards about which way he's ultimately going to go. But it does at the moment. So he's definitely the kind of neoconservative wing is winning out at the minute.
Publicly repudiated Tulsi Gabbard, who you know, at least has rhetorically claimed to be anti-intervention and supported Assad and that kind of stuff. You said something that I think is really important. You mentioned a minute ago, Iran, for whoever, who knows how long, is, you would not want to be, has no foreign interventions. It doesn't meddle or anything like that, unlike, say, Israel. But it is part of what you and others, we call the axis of resistance. You recently had a long piece on that in a magazine, journal, Jadalia. What's the axis of resistance? How does that play into this? Because in the absence of foreign intervention, it seems that's what Israel's really pissed off about, that Iran has been one of the few countries helping these folks stand up in Palestine in particular. And you mentioned there's been a long-term relationship between a lot of Arab nationalists and Palestine. Do you want to just give a little bit of background on the axis of resistance, what it means and how that's important in this regard?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I get in that like longer article, I made the case that there are these sort of deep kind of histories of sort of anti-colonial pan-Islamic solidarity on the one hand, but at the same time, this is gradually also evolved into both supporting allies with which they're genuinely, to which they're genuinely committed, but at the same time, it's because Iran is, it doesn't have NATO, it doesn't have allies, it's, and it has a sort of unremitting hostility from the United States, of course, above all, but then also Israel, as well as many states in the region, of course, are pretty much either client states or really little more, amount to little more than client states of the United States. So Iran did develop this kind of these asymmetric, non-conventional strategies. So on the one hand, like it did, when it's domestic capabilities, obviously the missile program, the drone program, if you see, you can't like wage a war through launching missiles. There's no ground campaign, there's no navy, there's no air force. A lot of Iran's air force goes back to the Shah's. They do not have F-16s and F-35s. They have like F-35s. They cannot compete with the Israelis in the air in this way. But they've basically managed to develop these cheaper technologies, which are supposed to act as a restraint, as a deterrence. That's one side. And the other side is obviously building these alliances with various groups and movements across the region, like Hezbollah, like Hamas in Yemen, who have their own program, have their own set of objectives, often like fighting foreign occupations, most likely, in most cases, it's the Israeli sort of occupation, ongoing kind of colonization, as well as because obviously Iran does have this broader strategic horizon of driving the United States out of the region. As we know, it's been successful maybe up to a point, but there's still many U.S. bases across the Middle East, whether it's in the Gulf, like the Al Udeid Air Base, and places like Qatar, where CENTCOM is literally based in the UAE, in Bahrain, as well as still in Iraq, smaller numbers of troops. But in Syria, obviously, we found this came subsequently. And yeah, as we know, the Netanyahu government, and I guess the Americans similarly, especially with the last couple of years, Iran and its allies have taken a very significant hit, particularly its allies have taken a very significant hit. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But they basically sought to portray it as a unique window, a unique moment to cut the, as the Israelis like to say, cut the head of the snake or whatever it is. But they don't realize that actually it's a much more kind of decentralized network. And actually a lot of these movements which are resisting Israel or the States or whoever, or Saudi Arabia and Yemen or whoever happens to be, they have their own anti-colonial, like national set of objectives. And yeah, Iran is offering support if it can. They're going to continue to do that with ever which way they can. And I think often, actually, to be honest, those who are more honest amongst that on that side do know this, but it doesn't matter. It's more like it's a very useful propaganda tool to paint, for instance, Hezbollah, not as a Lebanese force, but as an Iranian proxy, because there are obviously, Lebanon is self-polarized. And if you can portray them as simply nothing more than a foreign pawn, then it's part of the propaganda war, it's part of the psychological war which they're waging, right? But yeah, I mean, there is this question now, given that obviously Hezbollah was hit badly, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, then his successor, Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin, were both killed. And then, yeah, there has been this, in a sense, lopsided ceasefire in Lebanon, whereby the Israelis nevertheless have just continued to strike. But I do think there is a very good chance that, on the one hand, increasingly do think, I think it's more like this political decision that has to be made, as it were, that if Iran really is in deep trouble, and I think the reason why this happened is because Iran thinks it can handle it, and it thinks that it's, and I think it is basically getting ready for a longer campaign if necessary. The reason why Hezbollah hasn't stepped in is because it hasn't reached that point yet. It hasn't been necessary. But if it does, then they will. And it's the same, and it's slightly different, obviously, slightly different relationship in the case of Ansar Allah, the Houthis. But yeah, we could easily envision a situation whereby they move to close down the Bab al-Mandab Strait again, which had this huge impact on global shipping. And Iran hasn't even pulled its cards with regard to the Strait of Hormuz and all these sorts of things. That's also another thing we can talk
about. No, actually, that's a great point. What could, because right now it just looks like there's two parts to this. On one hand, what we're seeing are seeds of Iran getting pummeled, right? Tehran getting pummeled. But Israel's imposed censorship, right? And so we're not really sure what's going on there. But I know, for instance, I often relied on people who probably both of us know to send like videos from Gaza, right? To show what the Hamas and the other elements of the resistance were doing there. So I'm assuming Iran, it does have anti-aircraft missiles. It has longer range missiles. So is there any kind of, are you getting any information or is other media covering what is actually happening to Israel from these Iranian counterattacks? Let's start with that. Yeah,
no, I think it is. It's an interesting one because there have been various reports of this media blackout, which has been imposed within Israel, not to show any targets which have been hit. And that even the fact that this recently, there was news of this hospital was being hit, but that was obviously allowed because there's the desire to frame this as this awful regime, which is striking at hospitals, even despite the fact that the Israelis have completely and utterly destroyed the whole healthcare system within Gaza. But it's all part of that like big propaganda war. Within Iran itself, I do follow the same media quite closely and various other kind of like Telegram channels and things like this. And it does appear that Iran's strikes were initially in number were more significant, but actually gradually Iran is learning, even though, of course, its own capacities have been struck out and so on, but it too is learning the vulnerabilities in the Israeli air defense systems, and more are getting through, more are hitting precision targets. And I think Iran does understand that this isn't a matter of Iran overwhelming the Israelis, really. It's a matter of them basically enduring and outlasting them. And again, I'm not a military analyst, so I really put that like caveat out there. I'm a historian, but at least like from what from the analysis that I've been following, it does appear that, and this does seem to me very plausible, that only a certain number of these quite advanced interceptors, which Israel has via the United States, can be produced. And the United States doesn't have the actual military industrial capacity to produce these en masse. They can only produce like a certain number, like 150 approximately, for instance, annually. If Iran just continues to fire missiles, then actually it is actually going to get harder for them to repel. So I think it is actually clear that even though Israel has done a lot of damage and they did this initial kind of surprise attack, which is something which they just attack in this way. It's exactly what they did, similar to what they did in 1967, similarly via the air. So they're very effective at that. And they did have networks within Iran, which were firing drones and projectiles, and often assassinations were done like on the ground and things like quadcopters. And they're using all of these different techniques. But it does seem that Iran is still managing to fire in their direction. They are still hitting targets within Israel. It is inflicting a cost which I don't think they've really ever actually experienced, actually. They're used to doing that to all of their neighbors and just basically pummeling them into oblivion. They're very happy doing that. But I don't think they've experienced this level of actually punishment themselves. So I think Iran's, from what I understand from the Iranian strategy and what things that I have read and heard, is that they have prepared themselves for a long drawn out campaign if it gets, it could last for 12 to 18 months even. And that's what I've, again, I don't have any, I can't say that with 100%, but this is what I'm gathering. And I think they were aware to a large extent this day might come sooner or later, and obviously prepared for those contingencies, basically.
It's funny because Israel has this news blackout, but as in Gaza, you see this stuff, but most of it's just from TikTok and Twitter. They don't want the U.S. Americans to see it right now. That's more important than ever because the U.S. right now is sending Israel something, over $2 billion a week. And it's really an insane amount.
Yeah, right? With the interceptors too, I think they're spending, I think it was like something like $250 million. Like a day on these, which is just huge amounts of like money as well. Yeah, and Iran's been hitting all of these different sort of institutions. It is going to have a significant cost. I was speaking to a good friend of mine, Palestinian friend, who is like a 48er, who actually was visiting his family in Israel. I mean, he's a friend of a mutual friend of mine. Maybe you actually know him, actually, but I won't mention his name. But he was telling me that like the economy in Israel has come to a standstill. He was saying, don't believe the hype. Universities are closed, schools are closed, everything is disrupted. The idea that life is just going to get back to normal right away is not.
They've shut down the airports. They're not letting people out.
Absolutely. It does seem
that a million probably wouldn't come back. if they left.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it is inflicting a really serious cost, which, I mean, obviously the United States is there to pick up the tab for the time being, right? But so I don't think that's necessarily the issue. I think it's more this question of industrial capacity, the ability to produce these kind of these interceptors, so basically to continue to have the air defense systems working as effectively as they were at the outset. Because already in previous campaigns, so when the Houthis were striking at the Israelis, a previous True Promise 1 and 2, that already huge amount of resources had been put into that already. They're coming into this war with Iran and striking and attacking Iran 18 months in while they're having like wars on multiple fronts. Friends of mine looking on the Israeli side, they're saying, in their estimation, I'm not well placed to give like a conclusive on this, but in their estimation, like really more than a month, they can't probably take this. And I think that was already even indicated in Netanyahu's sort of comments where he was saying, oh, this is going to be 2 weeks. I think that's what he sold to Trump too. I think they laid out the networks they had, the intelligence they had, what they would do. And they just thought that the Iranian state, which is a real state, it's like a real state.
Sure.
It's a powerful state. And it's got, and it's not just that. It's like, it's basically has a military, an army, a revolutionary guard, and so on, militias, which were formed in an 8-year war. And then also are committed to, and also have regular, they have their problems. And they also, they're constantly fighting drug traffickers. They're constantly dealing with various kind of separatists and ethno-national discontent in the border regions of Iran. So they, while they haven't fought a full-blown war since obviously the late 80s, they have been engaged in all sorts of ways. And again, like I said, their whole doctrine is geared to deter and raise the cost, obviously, both for the Israelis and the US potentially. And that's the way they're thinking about it. I don't think they have any illusions that they can destroy or defeat the Israelis decisively in this way. But they think that they can actually raise the cost to such a point where they will have to ultimately back down and walk away from this in some way. And that's at least the way they've geared it.
I read a lot about kind of military planning. It's kind of one of the areas I like to study. And I've read a lot of kind of military people who've said, step back. It seems like the idea here is that Iran or Israel believes it can use air power to force Iran to submit. And as they point out, and you mentioned earlier, Israel has less than a tenth of the population, and it would be an invading army. And we saw what happened in Iraq, especially after the end of the war, right? I think that that's a piece of it that in the United States isn't really part of the discourse, that what happens, right? You can bomb them and then what? And as you pointed out, you'd be looking at a long-term war, which, like Iraq, inevitably would not end well. Inevitably.
Yeah, it's like Saddam's army was several hundred thousand, and many of them melted away, but then they have reappeared in different guises.
Yeah.
So you've got a Revolutionary Guard and an army, you've got a combined force of maybe several hundred thousand, 600,000 and something. They're not going to just disappear. This is like ridiculous. And I think actually just more combat is going to, if anything, it's going to harden the institution. It's going to force them to purge the weaknesses within it. It's going to force them to plug those holes. This intelligence penetration, which was clearly the case and very real, is going to sink or swim. We're going to have to basically address that and deal with that. And it's going to leave a far leaner, hardened institution. And whether you like it or not, I mean, I think it's because it's existential for them. And they're definitely not going to just simply pack up their bags.
Yeah.
So walk away. It's just, that's just a pipe dream.
Yeah. You have time for a couple more questions?
Of course. Yeah.
Great. This morning, the New York Times headline is Iran crisis shows limits of Chinese power. So they turn it into. But what's the international equation for all this? Iran at this point does seem, if not isolated, but doesn't have the same level of support. I guess Yemen is kind of part of that too. Is there any sense that there could be outside powers coming in either to try to broker a solution? That's not the way the Europeans are in Geneva today, because they've also basically greenlit Israel at the same time. But are there any maybe regional powers or China or whoever who could step in and try to be a mediating force in this?
Yeah, I did hear very critical statements by various kind of Chinese surrogates, right? They were very critical of Israel. But then I don't know, a lot of some of the analysis, again, I've read, basically was actually the Pentagon and Pentagon strategists have long, in a sense, sought to drag China exactly to this kind of like Middle East quagmire. And China's strategy has always been to basically take a step back and continue on the Belt and Road and building up their economic power and focusing on their own sphere of influence, obviously. And that's where, and of course, this does affect them because instability, they get a lot of their hydrocarbons from the Gulf. It comes through the Strait of Hormuz. They get it from a lot from Iran, but also from other Gulf states. And of course, it was China that stepped in to broker the detente with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Interested in instability. They're clearly not going to like this, I think, and the same with obviously Russia. But will they put it on the line for Iran? I don't think so. That's my sense. I'm not a China expert. I'm not a Russia expert. But my sense is, unless it got really bad, then maybe, like we saw the Russian intervention in Syria, perhaps you could. But then it would have to get to a really serious point. I don't think at the minute. And I did hear some negative and condemnatory statements from Russian analysts, but I think the statements I heard from Putin were quite, the Iranians haven't really asked us to be involved. And we've spoken to them about air defenses and they didn't show much interest. He was not particularly... He was quite nonchalant, actually. I was quite surprised. But yeah, I don't know. Evidence, if we look to past instances, I don't think we can count on, I don't think the cavalry is coming from either one of them. I guess one, because obviously Russia on the one hand has its own issues in Ukraine, of course, where it's fighting its own, in a sense, war against the Americans and NATO more broadly. And then, yeah, China, I guess strategy has been one of ensuring diplomacy, brokering diplomacy, trying to ensure stability. But yeah, actually getting embroiled. I did see some rumors about perhaps via Pakistan, that seems to have been probably one of the more outspoken regional states actually being quite outspoken and very critical. And I think they just met actually with Trump, right? So I think he'll be getting a very different perspective there than the one he's getting from Netanyahu, of course.
Yeah.
But so that might be one option. But I think, again, Iran generally has been through this before. They were pretty much alone in the 8-year war when pretty much the West was backing Saddam Hussein throughout that. And even the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union actually prohibited Libya from giving Iran Scuds. Right? And in the end, they had to get them from Pyongyang. So the world was really against, really. And they know that. And I think they realize that. And that's why there's this real culture and ethos of self-reliance as well.
Sure.
Inside that country, and they realize we have to be able to manufacture our own defense, our missiles, our drone capabilities. And this is also linked to why the nuclear program is, there's so much international investment, because again, it's seen as another way in which Iran secures that kind of self-reliance. And it just comes out of years and years of betrayals and imperial encroachments and many efforts to divide Iran into different spheres of influence and coups and proxy wars backed against it, more or less. And that's like a long history with which Iranians live.
What is Iran's military industry, weapons industry like? Or is it pretty much producing most of the stuff it has, or does it purchase weapons from other places, from other countries?
Again, I'm not a military analyst, but as far as I understand, obviously the drones and the missiles are all domestically produced.
Okay.
There was talk, obviously, about getting like Russian planes. I think the S-300 missile defense system, Russia, which is a Russian one. And there's always been this kind of, I was surprised by Putin's remarks, actually, because within Iran itself, there's always been this real irritation about distrust of Russia. One, because there's this history going back to Catherine the Great and everything, but which is revived. But there is also this sense the Russians weren't prepared to give Iran the more advanced air defense systems like the S-400 and so on. And like, even, I mean, there was this recording of Javad Zarif that was leaked. And obviously he's more inclined to, he's pushing for diplomacy with the West and this pragmatic attitude and so on. And there are different voices within the system more keen on a turn eastward. But his point, and I think this is a broad suspicion within a large part of the Iranian elite, is that the Russians are an ally, but at the same time, they benefit from Iran being in this position where it's encircled by the West, is under threat from the West, and is weakened, but is never in a sense, but isn't falling. So in a sense, it's in this, it's always has this need for a Russian sort of support. And they're always worried that Russia will ultimately try to use it as a pawn in their own broader, maybe geopolitical, agenda and so on. So there is that suspicion in Iran itself. The attitude with China is different because obviously there isn't this history there. But again, I did see this post. I don't know how true it is, but it was interesting and it seemed very plausible to me. And I spoke to friends about it and they said it was very plausible by Chinese analysts. And They were arguing that basically Iran had the opportunity to buy these really advanced air defense systems from China. And then ultimately they did it because they really still didn't fully have the faith in the Chinese technology. They preferred their Russian counterpart or even Western technology. And apparently the Pakistanis bought it and it worked very effectively in their latest fracas with India. So there's a discussion there about maybe Iran did make some mistakes in because it does obviously have its own indigenous capacities, which does build its own sort of anti-ballistic missiles, air defense systems as well. But whether these are quite on a par with kind of Chinese counterpart is, I doubt it, to be honest. And we've obviously seen a lot of damage. We have seen a lot of actually effective air defense. Yeah, when I was speaking to relatives inside Tehran, you could just hear it. It was just constantly shooting drones and missiles out. And it was constant. It was all night. And people were not sleeping, not because necessarily even of fear. They were not sleeping because it was just constant noise, barrage after barrage after barrage. So it is working, but at the same time, clearly a lot is also, a hell of a lot is getting through. Yeah, no, it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge. It's a difficult one. And I guess under war conditions, the question is like, how much can Iran redress that? Would China be willing or would Russia be willing to provide them with more advanced kit? Can they then set up in a way which isn't then susceptible to Israeli attacks from the air again? And all these things are open questions, which we don't have conclusive answers for.
I'm old enough to remember the oil shocks of 1973 and 79. And there's been a few mentions of oil and especially like possibility of closing the Straits of Hormuz, which would obviously badly disrupt the global oil market. In the Iranian media, are they talking about that in the Iranian press?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I think like on the one hand, Iran is saying that this is a policy of last resort. Like, I think they... Because there are people who are kind of outriders and surrogates who speak on sort of behalf and represent the Iranian position who very frequently threaten this. But of course, there is this danger that if you constantly put that out there, the bluff gets called and it becomes like an empty threat. Actual officials that I've seen, they're very reluctant. They've actually been saying to the government, because they understand if they start threatening, because that would have massively impacted the Arab states in the Gulf negatively, and also negatively impact China. They're very careful about that because they understand that could actually alienate the Gulf. And at the minute, the Gulf is trying to play this sort of, is taking this position where they don't support these attacks on Iran. Well, of course, they many of them host US bases. I don't think their leaderships, they understand the heavy costs this could have for them. If Iran was really to basically reach the end of the line and say, really decide this is an existential matter of life and death, and then they did target US bases across the region, that would just devastate the whole regional economy. This is why I really wonder, and I'm trying, it's difficult to figure out what Trump's thinking is, because he literally just did this huge tour of the Gulf, talking about these like trillions which he's going to generate, when this really does have the potential to cause huge, immense damage to that across the region. So from the Iranian perspective, they've been saying, no, we're not going to do that unless the Americans literally start attacking us from these bases. Then we might consider targeting the Strait of Hormuz. Then we might start actually targeting American bases. I think at the minute, what I've seen is that they have been, my guess is, based on some of the reporting that I've seen, is that they have been using jamming to target some of these ships. And there was like this crash recently in the Straits, which then they caught on fire. I think that maybe was an initial, in a sense, warning, and it gave Iran some plausible deniability. That's my guess. And we have seen then insurance for shipping coming through the Strait doubling. So already there's going to be a knock-on effect on oil and gas prices, because 20% of oil comes through, 20% of liquefied gas comes through the Strait. Global supply, like it's a lot. Like, so I think, and again, Iran doesn't want to play that card, because I think that would be one of the last cards that they would want to play.
Yeah. In the 1940s, there were American military officials reluctant to recognize Israel for that exact reason, because of shipping lanes, right, in the region. Yeah. This has been great. One last thing, because this is the elephant in the room. The United States keeps talking about regime change, right? And you get these really breathless things. The New York Times said, beneath Israel's bombs lies an unpopular, repressive Iranian regime that has spent billions on nuclear program projecting. And so we get this kind of appeal to, especially to, I would say, American liberals and American feminists. Don't you think Iran should be overthrown? Look at what they're doing to women. Look at what a repressive, it's a religious, it's a theocratic state. Not that the U.S. isn't right now. 3 years ago, Noam Chomsky said, Chomsky years ago said, in Iran, they believe in science. In the U.S., you have people thinking the world is 4,000 years old. But how it's... I'm a secularist, right? I'm an atheist, basically. So I don't want to see any kind of religious government, but I think also anytime I hear the people are going to rise up, they said that about Saddam, right? You just know from history that ain't going to happen, right? What I mean, is this in many ways, this increases support for the regime. Is that what you're saying in Iran? Because
yeah, look, Iran is like any society. There are class divisions. There are political differences. There are those different religious beliefs. There's those who are more secular. Those who are more religious. There's those who are politically religious. There's those who are apolitical and religious. There are those as ethnic national minorities who very much identify with Iran. There are those who do not. There's a whole bag of things. It's like any society. The society is homogeneous, right? Even those which maybe could make more of a claim to be so. There's always going to be these different kind of divisions. And these exist and these do exist in Iranian society, of course. And there are religious women and there are women who identify the same. There's women who are religious women who are against mandatory hijab. And obviously we've seen over the last couple of years, this is actually the state has bow to pressure on this significantly, I think, and has been smart to do. And there's all of that. But the reality of it is when you basically, as I argue in the piece, and I think as others are arguing, and as I know, like in my bones, Iranian nationalism takes many forms, but it is a strong force. And people identify with Iran as a home, as a homeland. They call it Vatan, Watan in Arabic, but Vatan in Persian. And it is deep. I have seen people who do not like the regime, who really hate the Islamic Republic, like being like, burn in hell, Netanyahu, but go to hell. There's no way in hell that we have any sort of misconceptions that you're going to bring us freedom and any of this sort of stuff. And yeah, you had even Iranians who weren't particularly maybe sympathetic of what was going on in Lebanon and Gaza, to be honest. And you do find that among some quarters of middle-class opinion. That does exist. And it's because obviously it's seen as a state project. I think before the revolution, maybe Iran was probably one of the most pro-Palestinian, like Muslim nations in the world. Obviously, I guess over years, as they see it's been co-opted by the state, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that. That exists. There's a lot of people who also identify with that cause as well. There are. But I would say this attack on the country, and basically not just that, it's just the level of audacity and hubris that you have, like, it being openly discussed in the Jerusalem Post that we're going to balkanize and turn Iran into a bunch of various different little ethnic statelets that can be controlled and manipulated. That really fundamentally triggers, to use an American expression, that really triggers something really deep in Iranians. I think they get that completely. And yeah, of course, there will be some people who, no matter what, they're so propagandized by these diaspora TV channels and so on, that maybe they don't think this way. What I've seen overwhelmingly has been a very, even more than I would have expected, to be honest, a sort of a coming together, a sense of national unity. I've also seen some polling inside Iran, which has been interesting. Again, I wouldn't say give this sort of, this is gospel, but really, at least according to that poll, it was an 80-85%, I believe it was, supporting the retaliations against Israel for the attack. It's a huge number of people. And it's just what you would expect. Imagine even in the United States, however, it's such a riven, polarized society, right? But you can imagine if a bigger power came along and all of a sudden basically threatened to, was bombing the United States, you could imagine a lot of people probably would put their political differences to one side. So we should just think of it in those terms. Iran is a society like any other society. They're human beings. They've got their differences between themselves. But when it's like a foreign aggressor, and killing civilians as well. That's just so clear. And it's just spiraled. And children and so on. Then I think people have put those to a large extent to one side.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw this, but today, along those lines, it's a perfect segue, right? The New York Times again. Some Iranians so despise the clerical leaders that they have at times looked to Israel as an ally and openly hope for the United States to install new leadership. This is the kind of stuff you would read in 2001 regarding Saddam in Iraq, just switched the words out. So they're greasing the skids in that regard and, ignoring everything else that's gone on. Right?
Yeah, but even just to put it in perspective though, Bob, I would say that I have occasionally, unfortunately, encountered these kinds of people.
Oh, I'm sure they exist, right?
Yeah, but what I want to say though is that it's all cheap to say that when it's in the abstract, when you're just very angry at the government or whatever. But then what I've seen actually is the second we've actually seen Iran being attacked, that's collapsed. And I've actually seen, it's interesting to see actually, the Nobel Prize winners, Shirin Ebadi and Narges Mohammadi, basically, and a bunch of others put out this statement, basically blaming Iran, basically casting the blame on Iran in many ways and saying, it needs to give up enrichment. They were absolutely criticized to the hilt. And people I wouldn't even expect it. They just absolutely let them have it. And the same with the absolute pathetic fail son, which is Reza Pahlavi. He's just so blatantly sided with the Israelis. Obviously, he previously had gone to Israel to basically to pledge fealty to like Netanyahu. And I think he has also absolutely sided with the Israelis. He's basically going on the BBC and other channels saying the Iranians welcome this. And I think he already really lacked credibility, but now he's just really, even amongst many royalists, because you even actually have royalists. You have royalists, and I know them well. I have some in my family who are actual nationalists at the end of the day. They might not like the regime, but they're nationalists. And they see any support for like foreign attack as complete betrayal. And it's treason. And that's how they frame it. They say, this is treason. Like, you can't, whatever the Islamic Republic is, it's like in the family, we have to solve this amongst us as Iranians kind of thing. So that's important to note, yeah.
Even in American circles, what I'm reading is that they don't want the Pahlavis anywhere near this. They know that's because I've seen he's reappeared in Twitter and everywhere. And just, it's funny because in many ways, this just follows the same pattern that I've seen so many times. I did a talk last week on comparing Vietnam and Palestine. And the rhetoric, like the piece I just read, that quote I just read from the New York Times, you would hear the United States say that about Cuba, Vietnam, they're going to get rid of these people. They're unhappy. Venezuela, Indonesia, Guatemala, you name it. It's just universal. It's like they have this template and they just change the names.
Totally. It's remarked on a lot now. And I think I read about it in the piece, but it's obviously the Iraq war script. But like the same was obviously said about Kamal Abdel Nasser before.
Yeah.
And so many other figures. There's always this sort of threat, this hidden right figure, this imminent threat. And it's just, I think I wrote in that NLR piece that it was like, this is like a caricature even of that.
It is.
It's just so utterly, obviously fraudulent. And it's just so ridiculous. Iran was literally in the middle of negotiations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Israel assassinated the negotiators.
Yeah, they assassinated. Yeah, exactly. Ali Shamkhani. He was a military figure. And formerly, he was the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, which is, it's like the director of national intelligence, for instance, some of that kind of role. And then, and this way, he was a significant figure, but he was like an advisor to the supreme leader. He wasn't like a military figure. And he was known as a pragmatist.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He was a pragmatist. He was absolutely, I'm sure you saw that he went on, I can't remember what American network he went on, but he went on these American networks and said, we're ready to do a deal. And he was actually getting a lot of criticism from people who were far more, I don't like to use this word, but I guess, how can I put it, hard line, who were much more skeptical about dealing with the US. I mean, he was subject to a lot of criticism for them. And they killed him, which obviously you know that the Israelis don't want a deal. And I guess it's the question, which we still don't fully know, is the degree of Trump collusion, or whether he tried to own it after the fact, or whether this was all part of that whole ruse. I guess in the future, maybe we'll know, but we'll figure it out. But either way, obviously the result is the same. The outcome is the
same. I mean, the U.S. is always afraid peace might break out. And that's the reason JFK overthrew ZM. They were making overtures. The North and South were talking about a reconciliation government, and Kennedy freaked out, didn't want that. He was afraid there'd be peace in Vietnam. This is it, Senator. This has been fantastic. We didn't even talk about Miriam Adelson and Bill Ackman and all kinds of other stuff. But this has been fantastic. I really appreciate what you're doing. I know how hard it is to not only have this scholarly academic involvement, to have a personal stake in it too. I know here in the U.S. we're going crazy and I can't even imagine what it's like. I really appreciate it and hope you and your family are doing okay as much as possible. And
thank you for having me. Keep doing the work you're doing, because we really...
I should have said this at the beginning. You mentioned it in the newest New Left Review sidecar. You have a piece called Culmination. You have three or four at least other pieces there. We'll put it in the notes, but if you're out there and you want to know more, just look up Eskander's name, and he's as good as anybody doing this and been doing a lot of media, which is really great. And thanks for having that voice out there. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
And this has been Green and Red Podcast. Bob Pizzico, co-host. Scott's not here today, but he'll be back. And make sure you follow us on all the social media and all that kind of stuff. I'm not really the pro at this part, so you can always do a Google search on it. Thanks so much.